Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
There are a lot of variables very much outside of my control that determine the size of a turkey, mainly weather.
That's farmer Mandy Corey. We visit her and her 900 turkeys to talk about what it takes to bring local birds to local dinner tables. Before that, soaring farmland prices are enticing investors to put their money into farming. That report from Harvest Public Media. Then in the kitchen, Chef Daniel Orr gives tips and tricks for making a juicy and flavorful turkey this holiday. We're getting ready for Thanksgiving on today's episode of Earth Eats. Stay with us. Our show always starts off with a look at the food stories that are making headlines. Mia Partlow is here. Hey there.
Hi, Annie. Three stories today. McDonald's has enjoyed a steady increase in profits since 2003. Until last month, that is. The fast food chain reported sales in stores open for more than 1 year had dropped 2.2% from last October. McDonald's CEO Don Thompson pointed to the demands of the global marketplace as a reason for declining sales, a combination of changing customer wants and needs, as well as increased competition from other restaurants like Wendy's and Burger King, have left their mark on the company's bottom line. Lawmakers in Denmark are planning to repeal the country's so-called fat tax 1 year after it was implemented. The tax charges consumers 16 kroner, or about $2.75, per kilogram of saturated fat. The goal is to reduce waistlines and increase life expectancies. The tax was widely criticized, saying it unfairly targeted the poor and would cost the country jobs, as Danes travel to Germany to buy groceries. In response to the announcement, a few public officials were quoted as saying they don't believe it's possible for a country to tax its way to health. But did the fat tax change Danish eating habits? A yet-to-be-published study by the Institute of Food and Resource Economics at Copenhagen University says it looks like it. That study says consumption of butter, margarine, and oil did fall by 10 to 20% in the 3 months after the tax went into effect. And we could see the extinction of wild Arabica coffee within 70 years. That's according to a new study conducted by scientists at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, in collaboration with scientists in Ethiopia. The report says Arabicas grown in the world's coffee plantations are from very limited genetic stock and are unlikely to have the flexibility required to cope with climate change and other threats like pests and diseases. Coffee is the second most traded commodity after oil and is crucial to the economies of several countries. Currently, prices are the most expensive they've been in 30 years due to a combination of high demand and poor harvests. Read more news updates like this on our social media platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook by searching for Earth Eats.
Mia Partlow, the voice of our food news headlines. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Across the Corn Belt, farmland is selling at record high prices. Just last month, an 80-acre tract in Sioux City, Iowa, went for nearly $22,000 an acre. That's five times more than the land sold for only 5 years ago. Sales are being driven by high crop prices and good returns on farmland when compared with bonds, gold, and even the stock market. From Missouri, Harvest Public Media's Abby Fentress Swanson reports that these returns are enticing traditional investors to put their money into non-traditional investments.
I'm standing here in Saline County on a piece of beautiful farmland, which is some of the best land for growing corn in Missouri. 5 years ago, this piece of land would have sold for maybe $4,000, $5,000 an acre. Now that price has doubled, and this piece of land sold for $10,700 an acre last year.
You want a quad?
Yes, I do.
Howard Oddsley has appraised land here in Missouri for 30 years. Wearing dark glasses and a crew cut, he walks into the middle of a field on this 160-acre tract and bends his tall body to pick up a clod of dirt. As it crumbles in the wind, he explains why this land is so valuable.
This is all very loamy, very productive but loamy soil. A high clay soil will just be like a rock, and that's the difference between the way the soils. And the farmers know this, and the investors know this, and that's why they pay for what they do.
Top dollar.
It's not just the value of Missouri cropland that's rising. Farmland prices all over the region, from Iowa to Illinois, Nebraska to Kansas, have been sky high lately, in part thanks to corn prices topping $8 a bushel. That's helped encourage investors with no connection to farmland to compete for their very own acreage. Investors like Steve Diggle.
We paid about $3.3 million for our 650 acres odd in southeast Illinois in late 2009.
Diggle is the CEO of a company called Volpace Investment Management, which is based in Singapore. The firm manages $250 million of investors' money. About 15% of that is in farmland.
This year we sold it at auction. We got $5.1 million. That's 55% higher than we paid. Plus, we got two yields, one of 3.5% and one of 5%. So, you know, as an investment, that, you know, 63% over 3 years is great, and we're extremely happy with it.
But you don't have to spend millions to buy farmland. Physics professor Andy Troopen lives in Delray Beach, Florida. He bought a 155-acre tract for $1,000 an acre in East Central Kansas 2 years ago because it looked like it would make him more money than gold or the stock market.
Farmland seemed like a much safer vehicle to get an income stream, even though if it's not a high income stream, at least it's more than you would get on treasuries at any duration. And at the same time, offer price appreciation or at least hold its value in the event of an inflation period.
Troopen bought the land after seeing it online. He contacted the listing agent, who worked for Realty Executives of Kansas City, for assistance with the purchase. The company holds seminars to walk farmland investors through things like how to find farmers to rent their land and how to follow commodities markets.
We have a lot of outside interest from Texas, New York, Chicago. I can just give you a few that just called here in the last week.
That's Dale Hermrick. He works for Realty Executives of Kansas City, and he used to advise former Senator Bob Dole on agricultural policies.
I've got an investor out of California that's looking at some land. There's really no exception of any state. It's just I get calls and inquiries all over the United States.
Hermrick's driving me to a 320-acre tract of high-quality cropland an hour south of Kansas City. He just sold the land for $3,600 an acre.
I have people call me all the time, and I just simply don't have what they're looking for, simply supply-demand. It's just not there. That's probably one of my biggest issues. I could sell an awful lot more of this land if it was available. And people seem to hang on to something that's making some money and real popular. It's just real popular, not owned land.
The small supply of land available could lead to a cutthroat market, which may even edge some farmers who can't pay millions in cash out of the game. But does this sound familiar? Back in 2006, a housing bubble burst, in part because of rapid and ultimately unsustainable increases in housing prices. University of Missouri agriculture economist Ron Plain says that farmland is a great investment, but he's also concerned that a similar bubble could be happening in farmland.
When you're at record high crop prices, it's reasonable to expect you're going to stop being at record levels. Lower prices means less income per acre and therefore less ability to pay for farmland. So yes, that's a very real possibility and a concern for investors.
Should a bubble burst, farmland might be harder to sell, especially compared to other more liquid investments.
Farmland is unique. Every parcel is different, and if you want to buy or sell, you'll find it's a long, slow process. So that becomes a real negative for a lot of people who are trying to move between different types of investment to capitalize on what's got the greatest return at the moment.
But investors argue that any bubble is still far off and believe that farm acreage will remain a solid, long-term investment so long as the demand for food continues to grow. Abby Fentress-Swanson, Harvest Public Media.
For an interactive map that shows the 10-year change in cropland values in the Corn Belt, go to harvestpublicmedia.org. Thanksgiving feasts would not be complete without a turkey, and we'll be cooking a bird in the second half of the show. But first, we're visiting a local farm to see how the turkeys are raised. Schacht Farm is a 57-acre stretch of land just outside Bloomington, Indiana. Owner Mandy Corey raises chickens and hogs year-round. Those chickens produce apparently 20,000 dozens of eggs a year. Wow. This time of year, she makes room on the farm for turkeys. Corey has been raising these turkeys for 4 months now, moving them from pasture to pasture, and after next week, they'll all be gone.
This is my 7th year raising turkeys, and every year, and they're a whole lot of fun, but you have to be very open to a lot of possibilities of things that can go right or things that can go wrong.
The weather is the biggest unknown, she says. Today, it's rainy and chilly. Other than having their feathers matted down as a result, the birds don't seem to mind too much. They were recently moved into this fresh 2-acre pasture, which is surrounded by an electrical fence and protected by the Great Pyrenees savanna. Corey takes us on a walk from the farmhouse past the turkeys' former nursery and the several pastures they decimated earlier in the year, and up a hill to visit them in their final home.
I order them. Usually I do all my planning for the upcoming year when I have time, which is in the winter. So probably January of last year, I ordered the birds, and they arrived in mid-July as day-old poults, which is the name commonly used for baby turkey.
So do you get, like, personally, emotionally attached to these guys?
To the turkeys? No, I am very much amused by them and love raising them. But as far as emotional attachment goes, there's not a whole lot in there to get attached to.
The bird is what it is. There's nothing beyond.
There's nothing beyond those eyes that you see.
So I don't suppose turkeys have personalities like they say chickens do?
You know, we were thinking about this the other day, but I think that turkeys most resemble by personality goats. They're very mischievous, and they get into all kinds of trouble. And they like to be up high. Just like goats, seriously.
Didn't know that about goats, yes. Actually.
Okay, so the turkeys spend their first 8 weeks in the brooder, which is just a poultry nursery, until they're feathered out enough and big enough that they can withstand a rainy day such as this.
Feathered out just means literally more feathers on their
back. They have feathers, yes. They're just kind of little fluff balls when they first arrive. So we take them out of the brooder at 8 weeks. They literally have started down here in this pasture and literally have worked, by the time we will have processed them, they'll cover about 12 acres. For example, on Monday, we fenced in a 2-acre paddock, and that'll last them, when they get this big, about a week, week and a half, and that's it. Of course, they can stay on that amount of land much longer when they're smaller and their foraging demands are much less.
So how big are these turkeys going to be when you process them for folks for Thanksgiving?
Well, they're still walking around, so I'm not exactly sure, but somewhere around 16 to 22 pounds. There are a lot of variables very much outside of my control that determine the size of a turkey, mainly weather. The amount of rain that we get determines how well the forage, you know, the grasses and legumes grow. How mild the temperature is determines how much of their food needs to go toward just simply keeping them warm as opposed to growing.
We're approaching the big, oh my gosh, there are millions of them.
Yes.
Can you give me a head count?
About 900. Hello, hello, hello!
That was so awesome. Thank you for doing that.
So looking out at these guys, they arrived in through the mail in 9 little boxes. And now...
Oh, and they're running toward us. Do they think we're going to feed them?
No, they're very curious by nature. They want to know what's going on. They want to know who you are. They're, you know, flock creatures too, so...
So I'm seeing white and black birds. Is there a difference here between the white and the black turkeys?
Yes, the black ones are actually called bronze is their technical name. They are a strain of like the old standard heritage bronze turkey, the standard bronze turkey. And the white birds are just the conventional broad-breasted. I raise both because the bronze are better foragers, but they mimic each other's behavior. So the bronze actually teach the white how to forage,
and they get along just fine. So
I have to tell you, I'm not afraid of birds, but seeing them all
it's
like stalked.
It's a little intimidating.
It's a lot intimidating.
Yes.
It's
like,
see photos of Mandy Corey and her noisy turkeys on our website, eartheats.org. Coming up, turkey tips from the chef.
The other thing that a lot of people do is they stuff the bird, but what that does actually makes it take a lot longer to cook, and you're much more likely to have a dry breast that way.
Daniel Orr gives a Thanksgiving turkey cooking tutorial coming up in a few.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh local organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop, and Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Yeah, well, I think that something that you need to do is really plan out your menu. And what you can do is make a list of dishes that you want to make and figure out how long it's going to take you so you don't get caught with your apron down at mealtime. But what you want to do is to do as much in advance as possible. So when your guests arrive, all you should be doing is pulling things out of the oven. I'm going to get a pot on, so just bear with me for a second.
Chef Daniel Orr is planning his Thanksgiving menu already. He'll be giving tips and tricks for making the best turkey ever in just a moment. But he's not forsaking the vegetarians on his guest list this holiday. Here's a nice meatless starter, quinoa with caramelized onions.
Okay, it's important whenever you're cooking something to always preheat your pan on the fire. A lot of people, they'll just throw a pan on and they'll try to start cooking, and it's inevitably going to stick. So you want to preheat your pan, let it get nice and hot, and then you're going to add your oil. You don't want to add your oil to a cold pan either. So keep that tip in your back pocket. Okay, we're going to do, one of my favorite things. It's always adding a bunch of garlic. Okay, once that's gotten nice and toasty, we're going to add some thinly sliced onions.
Garlic and onions, you better love your family.
Yeah, yeah. But to me, when you go into a home and you smell slow-cooking onions, I mean, it just smells like home. Okay, and we're going to let these get all caramelized and brown. And what that does is it's the natural sugars in the onions, when you sweat them, that moisture comes out, and those sugars get into the pan, they start to caramelize, just if you were caramelizing sugar. And that's what you want. That's what you're trying to build in this dish, is that layer of sweetness for the quinoa. You can see that the moisture has cooked out of these and now they're starting to dry out. You start hearing that sizzle. A lot of people don't know that you need to cook with all of your senses. So be aware, don't have more than one glass of wine while you're cooking because then you're headed for disaster.
Yeah, and if you're doing all this cooking, you get the first glass of wine.
Well, that's what we call the cooking wine.
All right. There's another tip for you.
The chef always has to have the cooking wine and always gets to eat the oysters out of the back of the turkey. Those should never even hit the dining room. All right, we're getting close. But you can't rush good food. All right, so we're going to wait another 5 minutes. Okay, we're back. You can see now that we've got this really nice caramelization in the pan. The onions are starting to brown. Okay, we're going to add the quinoa. Okay, and then we're going to add some water. And you can always add more liquid, but you can't take it out very easily once it's in there. So err on putting too little in, and then you can always add more if it's needed. And the way you'll know it's needed is by taste. What you want to do, let this cook for 10, 15 minutes, and then take a spoon and dip it in there. The quinoa, you shouldn't have that starchiness, so it should almost be like a cooked pasta. So we're going to add the remaining seasonings. All right.
Great.
Want to give it a taste?
Absolutely. It was really nice. Great little dish. Now to the meat of the matter.
Well, you know, the earliest Thanksgiving, first Thanksgiving, was spent with wild turkey, but also venison and wild boar and lots of other different meats, as well as the bounty of the sea, because they were just living right on the East Coast. But, I mean, we really love the turkey. It's kind of the emblem of Thanksgiving. And if Benjamin Franklin would have had his way, the turkey would have been our national bird. In a certain way, it still is at Thanksgiving time. So what we've done is we've roasted a bird. I just want to tell you a little bit about it. I mean, a lot of people have had those dry, dry turkey breasts. Got to put tons of gravy on it just to make it slide down. So what we do here at the restaurant is we brine the bird. And brining is a way of combining liquid, sugar, and salt, and then soaking the bird, and it absorbs that moisture. It's much less likely to get dry. But the main thing is not to overcook the bird. You know, a lot of turkeys come with a little thermometer that's right inside there. But I think that a lot of times when you use those, it actually overcooks the little bird. So the main thing is to get a safe temperature, which is 165. And you always want to take that temperature right at the thigh, at the part that takes the longest to cook. So you take a self-read thermometer, and you just kind of plunge it into that deepest part right by the bone into the thigh. You take it out of the oven around 155, and it will carry over cook, which means that the temperature that is on the outside of the bird is going to continue to penetrate into the center of the bird.
All that meat and no potatoes just ain't right, like green tomatoes. Yeah, I'm waiting, palpitating, with all that meat and no potatoes.
There are other ways that you can tell if your bird's cooked. You can jiggle the leg, and it should move freely. And you can also drain the juices. If you pick the bird up and drain the juice from the cavity out, it should run clear. Okay, and you see those nice clear juices. Man, that smells good. The other thing that a lot of people do is they stuff the bird, but what that does is actually makes it take a lot longer to cook, and you're much more likely to have a dry breast that way. What I always like to do is to cook the stuffing on the side in a nice casserole dish. It gets that nice crust on top, and I think it's even more delectable that way. But if you must, what I suggest you do is to stuff the front cavity instead of the back cavity. What I do here, as you can see, we've got some nice bay leaves, fresh bay leaves, rosemary, thyme, and we've seasoned the interior of the bird as well. And so that's Turkey 101 for Thanksgiving.
Easy enough. Check out photos of this beautiful bird and see a list of chef's turkey tips on our website, eartheats.org.
All right, so now we're going to carve the turkey. And another thing that a lot of people are intimidated by, but what I suggest you do is you make sure you have real sharp knives. So I'm running my boning knife on the steel. And then what you can do is you can partially bone the turkey in the kitchen. So then at the table, it's very, very easy to slice. So what we're going to do first is remove the wings, take off the legs. Okay, next we're going to take off the two breasts. So we're going to go right down to the wishbone. What you always want to do whenever you're carving anything, if it has a bone, is to get as close to that bone as you can. Always run your knife against the bone. Don't cut into the flesh. And always save that skin, you know. A lot of people fight over the skin.
Well, that's the best part.
Yeah,
that is the best part.
Yeah. Hopefully that's some Thanksgiving reservations coming in on the phone. one of the favorite parts for a chef is the oyster. And the oyster is right below that thigh joint. And it comes off in a little oyster-like ball. And Annie, I'm going to give you a little taste of that.
Oh, my goodness.
I've never tasted anything like that before.
Isn't that awesome?
Wow.
Well, it's that brine. Chef Bob made the brine. Bob, what else did you put in the brine?
In the brine, we have sorghum, sugar, salt, water.
We've got citrus, orange, lemons, limes, and then a myriad of spices, cloves, allspice, bay leaves, oregano.
Everything.
A little bit of everything. We've got some of Chef Daniel's spice blends in there, also the new regime.
My turkey from my childhood was never that juicy. Yeah.
When you're buying a turkey, you want to get something that is is local if possible. Hopefully been free range. It's been able to run around a little bit, enjoy its life.
And happy birds taste better. They just do.
Yep, yep. You see, and we're going to show you a little presentation here. All right, so I've put a little bit of flour and kale down. And I'm just going to kind of rebuild this bird a little bit. We've got the leg and the thigh. You could decorate this with some lemons, some cranberries, oranges, just make it really, really pretty. And that's a new presentation for a turkey that everyone can do, and it makes it much easier at the table.
Didn't catch all that? Read a list of Chef Orr's tips and tricks for making the perfect turkey this Thanksgiving on our website, eartheats.org. There are a couple awesome pictures there to get you salivating as well. One more thing. No turkey would be complete without the gravy.
All right. Well, one of the things that when you get your turkey, you're going to find this little mystery package on the inside called giblets. So what you want to do is save those, and you're going to make your gravy out of them. So what I like to do is to take the neck and take the gizzards. I will boil those until the gizzards are tender, and that takes a while. It takes maybe an hour, hour and a half. I like to cook my turkey with liquid in the pan because it keeps it moist, almost as steaming while it roasts. So you're making a really nice turkey sauce right in the bottom of the pan. Once you take your turkey out, you're going to let it rest for about a half an hour before you serve it. And resting a turkey will mean that the juices won't just run out when you start carving it. While the bird's resting, you take that pan with those juice, and maybe you've thrown in some carrots and some onions and garlic and all that stuff. Bring that to a boil and add your the liquid from the neck and the gizzards, and then you need to thicken that. And what we do in a restaurant is we use roux. Roux is half flour, half butter, and you cook that down for 15, 20 minutes until it starts to turn a little nutty, a little brown. And then you thicken that little by little. You add that to your roasting pan with that liquid, and basically that's gravy. Then you can strain it out. If you want to add a little bit of cream to it to make it a little more luxurious, you can do that. Sometimes it's nice to put a couple drops of truffle oil in there if you want to. Another way you could do it, if you wanted to have more of a kind of an Italian style gravy, you could add some diced tomatoes, some black olives, and some fresh basil, and that will take it in a completely different direction. So you can really kind of mix it up a little bit with your gravy. You don't have to stick to tradition.
We've posted a bunch of recipes on the site to change up your Thanksgiving traditions if you like. Reinvent them, perhaps. Like Stephanie Weaver's gluten-free jalapeno onion cornbread. Wow. If you're making a vegetarian Thanksgiving, our stuffed Turkish vegetables would be a great fit as well. So much to get your culinary juices flowing, all at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Aabon Binder, Mandy Corey, Sarah Gordon, Liz Leslie, Chef Daniel Orr, Mia Partlow, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop, and Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels, at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, Massage and Yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
And thanks to you for listening. Happy holidays. See you next week. I'm Annie Corrigan.